right here is for the people.
Welcome everyone to a landmark podcast number 30. Today we have the operations director for the Mindfulness in Schools project, Claire Kelly. As the Renaissance team continues with its mindful theme, we're always on the lookout for people that are going above and beyond to help spread the awareness of mindfulness. You know, we really believe that there are so many benefits that everyone can gain, especially students, from mindfulness. The research is not entirely there yet to back all the claims, especially improvement in grades. I kind of assume that if you did mindfulness meditation that your grades would improve. So we have to be very careful as to what we say the true effects are. Having said that, Claire has helped to shape the curriculum for thousands of students with her .B and her Pause.B programs that you can find out more about on the podcast, and I have links to that under the description below. And there are already many positive results that are happening. The results are coming in to help build a case to get mindfulness in schools. The Mindfulness in Schools project now delivers teacher and student training in 12 countries. Their work's been translated into 8 languages. Claire's also a trained teacher of the Mindfulness for Adults. Claire graduated from Cambridge University in Social and Political Science in 1988. She has worked in education for 25 years and most recently was deputy head at South Hampstead High School, one of the leading girls' schools in the UK, where she initiated a mindfulness program that continues today. Click on through the links under the podcast episode and you can follow all the work that is being done by the Mindfulness in Schools group. Usually with our Skype guests, there's a period before the podcast where we don't record and we introduce each other and kind of get a feel for each other. But when we spoke with Claire, the conversation got flowing straight away and we were getting into the juicy bits. So here's the podcast, and we actually join it midway through this introduction. So I hope you enjoy it.
Okay, great. And are you all mindfulness practitioners, or have you had experience of mindfulness?
We are, yes. So I started doing it as a school teacher. I was introduced to. So this is Anne speaking, by the way.
Hi.
Hi. I used to teach in a secondary school, and then now I'm a college lecturer, just FE College.
Uh-huh.
And in my previous place of work, a sixth form college, there was the college counsellor did a sort of a well-being course for staff, and it was centred around mindfulness, and that's how I was introduced to it. Uh-huh. And so it's been sort of two years now. So like you, I suppose I first found the benefits for myself as a practitioner, and then started doing implemented that in the classroom actually as well, which we'll probably discuss later on.
I actually picked up I guess a few years ago I got into from doing martial arts and a bit of trading, and I guess wealth psychology and neuro-linguistics. It kind of got me into the whole meditation thing. And only, I guess, recently became more aware of the term mindfulness. So I've kind of been practicing in my own, I wouldn't say it was called mindfulness, but as I've got to know mindfulness a lot more, it's been implemented more specifically to mindfulness or to that box that we call mindfulness.
Cool. Right. And Guy, what about you?
Yeah, so Anne introduced me to the concept of mindfulness about a year and a half ago. I thought I understood what it meant, and I was like, yeah, you know, being more aware, being more present, being able to take a step back and thinking twice before making a decision, you know. So I kind of understood it in that respect. Anne went to an Action for Happiness event that Jon Kabat-Zinn was speaking at. And in the Q&A session, Anne was able to ask a question, which is actually on YouTube as well. You referred to the London riots, didn't you? And
that's right, yes.
Your question to him was,
basically just how mindfulness could help.
Could it have prevented it?
Could it have prevented it, or preventing something similar happening in the future? And sort of to build a more compassionate society, I suppose, because I think a lot of the problems of those rioters, those kids, were probably to do with them perceiving their circumstances as somehow unfair and, you know, different social class and...
It's a big ask of mindfulness, though, isn't it? To sort of say, you know, solve socioeconomic problems.
Oh, yeah, it is. But I think it is a big ask. But I was thinking, because I grew up in a very deprived area myself, in fact, in Hackney.
I used to live in Hackney.
Okay, yeah. So do you know Dalston? Do you know Dalston at all?
Yeah, that's where I lived.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. So it's become very nice. It's become very trendy now, actually.
Oh, yeah, I can't afford to live there.
But... I was thinking a lot of the problems that you perceive, I mean, it is a big ask, as you say, but if sort of on an individual basis, if we can sort of see the world in a different way, realise that, you know, change our mind in a sense, change our perception of what we perceive to be unjust or unfair, and in fact, is it real or is it just a product of our thinking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, absolutely fascinating, the whole thing. And what did John
Kabat-Zinn
say in response?
No, so yeah, if I may, he said that you have to explain it to them on their level in their language. And what one thing he did point us to was to get in touch with the chaps who the Mind Body Awareness Project on the west coast of the States in California. Yeah. Where they work with incarcerated youth and at-risk youth. And so, based on that, I reached out to them and said, you know, explained a bit who we were, and they did a podcast with us. We had a great time. There was Sam and Micah, both senior instructors there. Yeah. And that really kind of, you know, it's kind of whet my appetite for understanding more about it. And then ever since then, it's been podcast after podcast.
Great. You know, similar work's going on here now with young offenders and kids in pupil referral units. And we've got a version of the R.B curriculum, our teen curriculum, has been written for gang members. So it's really taking off in the UK as well.
Yeah, well, what are the kind of results then that we're seeing with that?
Well, that area hasn't been researched thoroughly yet, certainly not as much as other areas of mindfulness in young people. But you know, kind of anecdotal evidence is that it's incredibly powerful. And, you know, when we start talking on the podcast, I can give you a few examples of what I've heard in terms of how it's worked. But yeah, it's very much in line with that idea that, you know, so much of social unrest and young people's disaffection with what's going on comes from a sense of reactivity. So, you know, just almost being taught to react to a situation where a response is more appropriate. Mm-hmm. You know, having you mentioned, I think, that opportunity to just step back and, you know, give yourself a moment to root yourself before going into a situation, whether that's a conflict situation or a, you know, just kind of a verbal exchange or whatever. So that kind of thing has been really beneficial. And also just in terms of, I'm reading a fantastic book at the moment called Dignity, which is about, it's written by someone who's done a lot of conflict resolution, but it's all about, you know, most conflict, most disagreement, whether it's social disobedience, whether it's young kids getting into fights, whether it's, you know, war, stems from a sense of lack of dignity. And I think mindfulness, amongst lots of other things, has a really important role to play in helping all people, but particularly young people, develop a sense of their own worth, their own sense of their place in the world. But I could talk for hours about that.
But what I do really, you know, like about this whole subject is that, as you said, not a lot of research has been done on it. You know, there's certainly, you know, a place for it. And I think it's exciting that as more, you know, whether you refer to it as meditation or mindfulness, however you brand it.
Yeah.
The fact that this brand of mindfulness is, you know, starting to do so well, you know, thanks to you know, people like Kabat-Zinn, that owner Oprah Winfrey, Ellen DeGeneres, Russell Simmons, the Bank of England, Google.
Google. Google. Google. Google. Yeah. Tina Turner. She's more of a TM person, but
What about Goldie Hawn? that was one I saw the other day. Russell Brand, it's...
Yeah.
They're kind of, helping to bring it to the mainstream.
Yeah.
And, the significance of mindfulness, as, through the different podcasts, we're speaking to different people that are living it and practicing it in different areas. There is a common theme that it is changing parts of the brain. It is, the plasticity of the brain, it is affecting that in a very positive way.
Yeah.
And, one thing that we found as well by having all these interviews is that someone that does mindfulness and gets it, they never say that, they never go back from it afterwards. They may get a bit lazy, but they'll appreciate it and understand its value.
Yeah, you can't unlearn it. Once you've got the techniques, you can't unhave it. It's mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
We talk a lot with kids about having a toolbox. Mm-hmm. The tools are always going to be there. Whether you choose to use them is entirely up to you. And
right.
there are ways you can encourage young people to do that. But you're not going to get rid of the tools. Don't go. They're there.
Yeah, and it's...
Rocket science, it's really easy. I think the hardest bit is just doing it, isn't it, really? Just mm-hmm. sitting down and doing it.
So one of the questions we were asking along the way was, how young can you be? For you to be receptive to the concept of mind and its benefits.
Yeah.
Would
you answer that now or later?
Yeah, well, so I've actually been recording since we since we first spoke, and I can edit around and mix it up.
Yeah, yeah.
But we got into the juicy bit quite quickly that it's
just continue.
Be ashamed to waste it.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of a podcast. It is a conversation.
Yeah.
So why don't you give us a bit of an introduction about how you got into mindfulness and your role as operations director of the Mindfulness in Schools project. And perhaps if you can explain some of that.
Okay, so I've been a teacher for about age away now, but I've been teaching for about 25 years. And taught mainly at secondary school level and sixth form level. And my subject at university was social and political science, so kind of mainly focusing on psychology and politics and philosophy. And did the classic thing of going into teaching and then bit by bit getting promoted and finding myself in senior management level quite early on. And noticing the effect the stress of the job was having on me physically and mentally, and it kind of came to a turning point for me probably about 10 years ago when my hair was falling out and my fingernails were falling out, and I just realized that I was being a good girl and powering on and this was a tough job, but somebody had to do it and there's no reason why I shouldn't be that person. And just thought, this is ridiculous. I can't carry on like this. I'm no good to the people I'm working with. I'm certainly no good to the young people I'm working with in my current state. So I resolved to classic New Year's resolutions, I'm going to spend this year exploring how to change my relationship with what I do. And because it's very easy to say, well, it's about the job, it's about the job, it's about the school, it's about the people I work with, and they're all the problem. And actually I very quickly realized, having started doing a little bit of research into mindfulness, that they aren't necessarily the problem. My relationship with them is the problem. And John Kabat-Zinn, very famous, says, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. You can change how you relate to the difficulties. Life is always going to have difficulties, whether it's to do with work or home or your relationships. But you can change how you relate with them. Danger there, I should say right away, is that you could very easily turn around and say, isn't that just kind of giving in? Surely you should be challenging things that need to be changed. I completely agree with that. But a great starting point for me was just starting to do some mindfulness practice and learning how a lot of the issues I was dealing with were to do with my own relationship with thoughts and how I related to different situations and how I spent most of my time up in my head thinking. You know, Mark Williams calls it the doing mode, being in a state where I almost forgot I had a body. I was just a kind of a mind attached to my body. The body kind of trailed around after this brain that was kind of processing and thinking and planning and resolving and trying to reason its way out of difficult situations. So that was about 10 years ago. And it was only about 3 years ago that I, no, 4 years ago maybe, I had a chat with Chris Cullen, who was one of the co-founders of the Mindfulness in Schools project, who said, this is what we're doing. We're working in education. We're working with people who have a mindfulness practice. And do you want to get involved? And I said, absolutely. And from there, I introduced the .B curriculum, which is the teen curriculum from the Mindfulness in Schools project, into the school I was working with, starting with year 10, which is kind of, you know, 14 to 15 year olds. And then it spread through other year groups. And then I just decided to step away from full-time education and to do more stuff with mindfulness. And that's how I started working with Mindfulness in Schools project. So kind of, you know, a real transformation in terms of what I was doing. But suddenly everything made sense. Everything came together. My education experience, my interest in mindfulness, my background in psychology and philosophy, just all came together. And here I am now.
One of the things you mentioned about your experience as in senior management in a school and the toll it took on yourself, both physically and mentally, I was interested in the idea that well-being for staff and both, well, I suppose Mindfulness in Schools project is focusing on that. How important do you think it is that students should be taught the techniques of mindfulness in order that it could help to alleviate their stress, and well-being should be a big part of the curriculum and not just exam results? Because my big criticism of say being in a secondary school was that it was all our meetings was focused on sort of how many A stars to see, including maths and English, and very few meetings on how to help the students have a happier life, if that makes sense to you.
The obvious answer is I don't think whilst we're in an education system where, you know, we have league tables,
yeah,
and we have guidelines which, you know, Ofsted inspections, whatever, that all focus to a certain extent on outcome, we're never going to get over that issue about the pressure on exam results.
Yep.
And if I had a pound for every time I had someone contact me and say, where's the evidence that mindfulness helps exam results?
Mm-hmm.
I'd be a really wealthy person right now.
Yep.
All we can say there is what mindfulness does for you,
yep,
is have students who change their relationship with whatever situation they're in, whether it's an exam, whether it's a lesson, whether it's to do with peer relationships. Mm-hmm. And certainly my experience of the younger end of secondary school in particular, but upper end of primary, lower end of secondary, is that peer relationships are absolutely key for those kids.
Yeah.
And take a lot of emotional energy. All of those things can be affected by mindfulness practice. But having said that, the Mindfulness in Schools project has really shifted their emphasis. It all started with this teen curriculum, this 8-week curriculum, 40 minutes a week, classroom-based, using classroom kind of resources, PowerPoint presentations, film clips, making it as accessible as possible to young people. which was really successful, but we almost had to kind of backtrack and say, hang on a second, what we need is for those teachers who are teaching it to be practicing themselves. Yes. And unless you've got teachers who have a practice of their own, who have the skills and the knowledge and the understanding of mindfulness practice, who know that in order to support young people, they need to be taking care of themselves, yes, and being given permission to take care of themselves. Unless you have that in place, teaching the young people this stuff is not going to work. Yeah. You know, A, they get it, they notice, they think, well, you know, you're clearly not walking the talk, so yeah, why on earth would I engage with this?
It has to be more authentic, you have to embody what you're...
Yeah, and they get it, but God, they notice it straight away. Yeah. If you're not, you know, if you're going in there and saying, let's really root our attention in our breathing and our body, and let's look at how we relate to other things in the world and how we respond rather than react, and then they see you go down the hall and kick the photocopier, you know, they know immediately if you're blagging.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And also, staff, teachers, people in education, whether it's a teacher, whether it's the canteen person, whether it's a caretaker, whether it's support staff, whether it's a secretary, they all have an incredibly stressful job to do. Yeah. And I think it's ethically important that we support what they do in terms of providing them with a mindfulness experience as well. First of all, we won't let anyone train with us to teach any of our curricula unless they've already got an established mindfulness practice. So that they have to have done some kind of 8-week mindfulness introductory course, whether it's MBSR or MBCT, or we do something called Dotby Foundations, which is specifically for teachers and people working in education. They've got to have done that. Yes. They need to have done 6 months embedding their practice so that they really understand what it is they're doing and you know, really get a sense of how to embed it in their everyday lives. And then they go on and teach the young people. You know, it's like the oxygen mask idea. You know, when you're on an aeroplane and they say, if there's a you know, pressure changes in the cabin, put your own mask on first, then take care of the young person next to you. And that's exactly the same for mindfulness. You have to look after yourself, which is quite an alien concept for a lot of teachers, I think, giving yourself permission to be nice to yourself and put yourself first sometimes. Then you go on and you help younger people develop their own mindfulness practice. Mm-hmm. So that's a very long answer to a very simple question.
No, but I guess to continue that analogy, you know, I like that description, but also the fact that, you know, we all actually have that oxygen mask available to us, that little...
Yeah.
Like you said, that tool case of that you can dig into every now and then when you need it.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. It's funny, actually, because, you know, you hear a lot from people going, oh, well, mindfulness sounds great. Yeah, I've read a lot about it. It sounds really cool. Won't be doing it myself, but I know it's good for me. And I think it was the CEO of Google who said that in about 10 years' time, mindfulness is likely to be seen rather like going to the gym. I mean, everyone knows it's good for you. Mm. Not everybody does it. And that's fine. You know, I don't think we need to try and conquer the world with mindfulness. It wouldn't be a very mindful thing to do in the first place, I reckon. But certainly raising awareness of its benefits. And now we've got the research evidence to back that up. Hopefully people will begin to realise that it is something potentially incredibly beneficial. It isn't for everybody. You know, there are people who do it and, you know, that for whatever reason, it doesn't really hit the spot for them. And there are certain groups of people who perhaps should be looking at something else prior to doing mindfulness. But the evidence is there to show that, you know, if you want that toolkit, most people can benefit incredibly easily from doing it.
Well, one thing that Michael Breedy, you know, the youth mindfulness.
Last podcast. I picked the Dotby training course.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, one of the benefits he mentioned is that, you know, that there is that individual benefit, but there's also the collective classroom environment benefit. that, you know, a bit of mindfulness at the beginning can do, because I can imagine how I've never wanted to be a teacher here in the UK, especially secondary or college. It just, not only does, you know, it terrifies me, the idea of, you know, especially the way that, you know, some of the children are acting today. And another fact is that depression is increasing. You know, the clinical rates of the 50s is the national average now in most Western countries. And I'm sure in the teaching profession as well, it's, I think you mentioned that on a podcast, Claire, before, the, you know, the levels of depression in teaching, how that's, you know, that's becoming an issue.
Yeah, it is. I think we've got to be careful about not stereotyping either the kids or the adults. And it's a really, obviously it's a really complex thing. Who knows why this is happening? We've got ideas about why, for example, young people are really struggling in terms of depression and anxiety. If you're being really cynical, you could say it's because the criteria for classifying or identifying mental illness has changed. That's a really important point to make. You know, what 30, 40 years ago would have been considered clinically depressed is different today.
Very true, yeah.
However, you know, there are also shifts in behaviour, in terms of culture, in terms of what we have access to, in terms of the pressure to be constantly on the go, constantly thinking, constantly planning, potentially exacerbated by the fact that you go home at the end of the day now and there's no respite because you've got your email and you've got your phone and you've got, you know, your computer, and then there's a TV and kind of stuff, that relentless information input and perceived pressure to respond that certainly people of my generation didn't have as kids. You know, we went home and all right, we watched some telly and then we went to sleep, and there was no pressure to respond to an email or a message, text message or whatever. So it's a really tricky one, but, you know, it's there, and the World Health Organization is particularly clear on this stuff, which is that, you know, we're looking at an epidemic or a pandemic in the next kind of 8 to 10 years, where depression and mental illness overtakes things like cancer and heart disease as the major draw on health services, finance, you know, kind of national allocation of funds as an issue. And it's something that there's lots of people involved in trying to address this issue. I think people are gradually waking up to the fact that something has to shift, something has to happen to allow people to change how they respond to this stuff. You know, we can't keep pumping money into a health system that's already struggling and responds through that struggling in terms of, you know, potentially quick fixes in terms of medication. But we're not dealing with the cause, we're dealing with the symptoms. And that's where I feel mindfulness has a role to play. Not the only one by any means, but certainly it definitely has a role to play.
So what is, but didn't the NHS, didn't they get a grant, and aren't they implementing mindfulness meditation as a form of to remedy things like depression?
Yeah, it did. Thanks to the research of Mark Williams and Penman and people like that, you know, it's now recognised as a form of a very effective form of treatment for depression. By the National Institute of Clinical Excellence in NICE, which is the body that then allows the National Health Service to adopt a procedure. Mm-hmm. So the work that Mark and Danny did means that you can get mindfulness in the form of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy on the National Health Service. The problem is a lot of it access, really, kind of nationally, there are only certain areas where there's enough NBCT-trained practitioners available. And secondly, you know, the great irony of the situation is that GPs are so stressed and overworked themselves that they don't necessarily have the means, the time, the access to sit down and think, is this an appropriate thing for this person? can I put in place, you know, what we should do next?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not there. And so there's a lot of work going on at the moment in terms of training GPs.
Yeah.
And raising awareness within the community, that the medical community, that this is something that actually really, really works.
And
it's an incredibly powerful thing to be able to give people.
Yeah, I was just saying that I heard a stat that 4 out of 5 GPs are not even aware of mindfulness to even offer that as a prescription, you know. So, and the 1 in 5 that do, I can imagine, you know, either I, you know, prescribe some pills or I can do this long extended process of trying to get them into mindfulness and explain what it is. Because I think that's probably one of the difficult parts is, you know, trying to sell the idea that it works and that...
Yeah. But again, there's that wonderful analogy, isn't it? It's just like with the teachers and the students, the GPs and the patients. You can get the GPs into a situation where they're getting mindfulness training for their own well-being and then recognising the benefits potentially for patients. A, you change the relationship they have with their patients. I know they're under huge pressure in terms of time and resources, but I've heard... GPs speak very, very powerfully about how having done a mindfulness course changed A, how they relate to their patients,
mm-hmm.
and B, opening their mind to alternatives to what might have been an initial, you know, here you go, here's the prescription, off you go, you're out of my hair, I can move on to my next 10-minute appointment. So I think that's really critical as well. You know, it's a bit... It's a big scale thing. We need to start retraining GPs, retraining teachers. Chris Cullen has done doing wonderful work training parliamentarians, you know, MPs and peers, just really embedding mindfulness in the culture of the country as a whole, rather than just, you know, having little add-ons around a place where people go, "Oh, that's nice, but I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna get involved."
I was wondering if maybe. In the PGCE programs, where teachers are trained, where you know they could actually be exposed to some mindfulness, because there's, well, I remember doing my PGCE, and there was a lot of time, and we, you know, some of the time was spent not so fruitfully. We were just, I mean, has to be said, I think I could have benefited from being exposed to mindfulness. As I said, it wasn't until 6 years into my teaching, that I actually became aware. Funny, actually, a personal story of my exposure to mindfulness. It was meditation in the Buddhist context. My grandfather was, a practicing Buddhist and encouraged meditation to his children. You know, my uncles and aunts, and when I visited them in Vietnam, and I just stayed, because it was packaged in a religious context, I just didn't pay any attention to it. It was just part of his Buddhist practice. So I missed out on all that. And I think it was, there's something to be said about the branding, you know, how it's sold to people, if that makes sense, you know, how you package
Absolutely,
it.
Yeah.
Because if you, and to be clear that this is not a religious practice, and even colleagues, when I did the mindfulness practice with my classroom, just a 3-minute breathing space at the beginning.
Yeah.
And because they didn't look into it, they were like, "Oh, that's your religion." And I said, "No, this is completely secular. This is a non, you know, this is not religious practice. It's just a technique. That's all it is, you know, to help them pay attention, you know, and focus is always a vital skill in mathematics and in anything, really." So,
yeah.
But there's a misunderstanding. I think it's important. So now, actually, when I in the classroom, when I get them to focus on their breath, and I actually don't even use the word meditation at all. I just say this is just focus. We're just going to now do a focus, just like a sportsman. I try to sell it more like a training as a sportsman would.
Yeah.
Would.
Yes. Yeah. You're absolutely right. And it's We do the same, you know. We don't use the M word as in meditation at all in the first few lessons, because it has connotations, and not very often actually, because I think enough people now know that mindfulness is potentially something for everybody rather than, you know, based on a religious practice. What we do have is faith schools coming to us and saying, you know, we'd love to introduce this, but we think there'll be some resistance from some parents and teachers. You know, Buddhism by the back door and all that stuff. And what we always say is, you know, contemplative practices are part of every single religious or spiritual culture or practice. You know, there's, whether it's Hinduism, Sikhism, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, whatever, it's there. It's nothing specific to one religion. And thanks to the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn, we've seen it now work in incredibly clinical context. You know, it's not something that's associated with religion. You don't have to sit down in front of a statue of the Buddha. You don't even have to sit on a cushion. You don't have to have incense. You do it in the classroom. You have PowerPoint presentations. You know, it's something for everybody. But it's interesting you mentioned PGCE, and that's something really critical. Yes. Which is, it goes back to that thing about, you know, teachers needing it for their own well-being before they pass it on to someone else. The problem we're having in the UK at the moment is that PGCEs used to be delivered through universities and kind of centralised organisations, whether it's colleges or whatever. And now recent legislation means that it's now being farmed out to schools. Its hub is in schools.
Okay.
So whereas it would have been originally possible to go into these universities, and we are doing it with some universities, places like Aberdeen and Cardiff and Southampton, to train teachers and give them a skill for their own well-being, potentially with a view to them then going into a classroom and teaching mindfully. We now have a problem, which is that, you know, if you really want to get all trainee teachers doing PGC or whatever, you need to go into all schools who are actually offering that training. So that's a real issue for us. We're trying to think our way around it. But I just think, yeah, if you can get young teachers or, you know, new teachers experiencing mindfulness for their own well-being, helping them deal with the incredibly stressful first year of teaching and beyond. Nightmare, complete nightmare.
Yes.
In terms of the time, exhaustion, and what's thrown at you.
Yeah.
And then potentially, you know, go on and take some of that practice into classrooms and allow kids to practice that. It would be magic. There's this phrase that we use a lot, which I'm going to hope I get it the right way around. I'll probably get it the wrong way around. But firstly, be mindful. So develop your own practice. Teach mindfully. So go into a classroom and take some of the quality of mindfulness with you, whether it's just being really rooted, really centred, allowing yourself the opportunity to not get caught up in thoughts that may be negative thoughts, allowing yourself to respond rather than react, and finally teach mindfulness. So finally move and start teaching the kids how to develop those techniques themselves. But it's a great approach, and we're really keen to develop that part of our work.
You know, I've always said that teachers should get the best salaries, I mean, because they have the most important job.
Yeah.
You know, it's that ability to inspire. I think when you introduce a student to mindfulness, that, you know, you become that figure where you can inspire that. So everything else then that comes out of your mouth will be a bit respected a bit more because of that, you know, the role you play.
Well, since my exposure to mindfulness and, you know, personal well-being, I mean, as a maths teacher and someone who loves the subject, I think that it's more important that they their personal well-being. You could get an A star in maths, go off, work in the city, burn yourself out and get depressed, and I'm not sure how good that will be for someone's life. Just the grade. I mean, of course it's important. Of course it's useful for them economically and the intrinsic value of mathematics. I just find it fascinating in and of itself. There's, you know, without the potential earnings, of course you have to sell it somehow and say, oh, it's the highest paid A level, etc. But I think this, you know, without taking care of yourself, without the tools, or what good is good A levels, good, and then you're just unhappy. What benefit will you be to society, to your family, your loved ones? And yourself, if you have the academic credentials, but as a person, as a human being, you are miserable. And I think that I think it's actually more important than any other subject, you know, in the curriculum at the moment.
The question that springs to mind when you're saying that is, what is true wealth? Because you're talking about the, I guess, the superficial wealth of having a good job, etc., but then not having the mentality to support that wealth. So,
yes,
what a stability behind it.
Yeah.
The whole math thing is interesting. My colleague, James Gibbs, was a math teacher. He joined MISP. He's really interesting on this stuff, you know, the importance of developing quality of life as a teacher. And as a maths teacher in particular, you know, something that's associated with outcome, you know, from its very heart, it's all about outcome. You mentioned about kids doing maths thinking it's a route into finance or banking or whatever. The great thing about mindfulness, whatever the subject is you're doing, but I think particularly something like maths or science, is the way it opens up for creativity. You know, there's research evidence to back this idea up, that if you practice mindfulness regularly, the creative nature of your thinking shifts. So rather than doing maths in terms of, you know, where it's going to take you or what you're going to do, you actually begin to do that thing that so many professional mathematicians talk about, which is enjoy the beauty of it, enjoy the creativity of it, enjoy the imagination involved in it, enjoy the process of it, you know, the process of problem solving and how lovely that is.
Yes.
So really being in the moment with your maths or whatever subject it is you're teaching, whether it's French or biology or, you know, whatever. It's just, we've heard teachers talk about how it's transformed their relationship with their subject, as well as the relationship they have with the students.
Wow. Are you aware of the organisation Action for Happiness?
Yeah, of course.
Yes. I think they're fantastic. I mean, I've been to a few of their talks, and I think, again, I'm repeating myself a bit, but the idea of well-being in any workplace, not just in, you know, we've been talking a lot about the classroom and in the teaching profession. But I went to a talk by one of the Google guys, Chad Meng. I don't know if you...
Yeah.
Very, very entertaining speaker. Yeah. It was fantastic. And I think... and if Google, again, another selling point, actually, because, you know, is that, well, if it's good enough for Google, and they are probably, you know, I mean, I don't have the actual statistics, but certainly one of the most well-known, successful companies in the world at the moment. And it was good enough to... I know Goldman Sachs have got mindfulness, again, the banks and even Bank of England, I read. So you've got it's not like it's going to be a waste. It'll pay you back. If and Chad mentioned that in order to get people to be more compassionate and to bring world peace, that was his, you know, slightly ambitious. That was his aim at Google, but he had to sell it somehow to them. And it was, okay, this will make you more money, you know, because it's what gets the people, right? So this will make you more creative, this will make you more productive. And I think that, you know, personally, I mean, I think that if I'm happier, I have more energy, the students will respond to me better. And, you know, if I've got a flu and I'm coming into the classroom and I'm not all there, I'm not as good a teacher as I am if I'm just... had a fantastic weekend, well rested, come in there enthusiastic, and I can inject that enthusiasm into the classroom. So again, I think happiness and well-being should be at any corporate organisation or schools, and as a big part of their agenda, as a big part of mantra.
In exactly the same way, I mean, do you ever position mindfulness as to students, then instead of the money being the goal, to say this will get you better grades?
Yeah, I mean, okay. What I've said here about, I repeat it in the classroom. I said, it's, you know, of course, you're here for a reason. You're here because you want to go to university. I'm teaching A-level at the moment. And of course, that's important.
But
well-being. And so, again, how you sell it, how you brand it to them. And I say, well, if you look at And I'm not sure if Cristiano Ronaldo does practice mindfulness, I'm not sure. But when he takes his free kick and he sort of breathes in and sort of, you know, you've got 100,000 people looking at you, you're about to take a free kick.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's not being, you know, focusing your attention in that moment to take that free kick, which you've practiced hundreds, thousands of times on the training ground. But can you do it with the pressure of the crowd? And so these, I'm sure well, actually, John Kabat-Zinn mentioned that he trained the US Olympic rowing team. So it is, I think that taking it from a sports angle and again, away from the its religious roots.
Well, going back to the point that Claire made about, you know, some of the resistance from parents, you know, if you position it as this will get your children, you know, better grades or at least more concentration.
Yeah.
And the other tools necessary for that classroom environment for them to grow, and that the shape of the brain changes. I think, you know, when you position it like that, and you sell it as opposed to just meditation or mindfulness, you sell it as you would a business model,
as a tool to get better grades. And also, I mean, I was, again, no research on this, but I know that it's, say in maths, where if a student, and I've seen actually, you know, students sort of get stuck on one question in an exam, you know, and because of that question, I suppose their minds run away with, you know, so you just, one question's gone wrong, but you think, my gosh, this is now my life.
It spirals quickly out of control.
Exactly,
unless you can control
in
it.
In the exam itself. Am I going to get to university? And imagine all these thoughts going on, and then you've missed out on question four, but that doesn't mean questions five, six, seven are, you know, they're completely separate.
It's
but
the state fiction, isn't it?
Yeah. So as a tool for exam technique, I suppose.
But. Yeah.
I think we have to be quite careful here because on the one hand, you know, there's sufficient research evidence to back up the idea that mindfulness might be useful in terms of, you know, academic outcome, performance, all that stuff. You know, if for example, the idea that somebody who is anxious, overly anxious, overly stressed, unable to concentrate, unable to choose to focus their attention in a particular area, the idea that someone like that is going to succeed in an exam is, you know, debatable.
Yes.
But there's enough research evidence there at the moment in terms of executive functioning, cognitive functioning, and management of anxiety to suggest that this is a good thing to do if you want good outcome. However, there's a bigger issue here, really, which is to do with mindfulness generally and the fact that there's a real sense at the moment we're riding a wave. You know, there's enough stuff going on out there to make people feel like this is the next big thing.
Mm.
And the danger is, I think, that we, A, think it's a panacea, it's a cure-all for anything.
Yeah.
All you have to do is just kind of, I get these Google updates on Google alerts, on news items about mindfulness. And they're also, you know, it makes you better in bed, it makes you more successful as a business manager, it gives you good results, it makes you happier, it solves all the problems. And I think if we overpromise at this stage, we really shoot ourselves in the foot. A, because it doesn't cure everything, it doesn't solve everything.
No.
And secondly, it will become a fad.
Yes.
You know, and we are riding the wave, but the wave is going to crash.
Yeah.
And the question is, what's left at the end of it? You know, what's the aftermath? I think if we're very careful about what we promise or suggest it can do for us, we may be in a position to have it still there, whether it's, you know, it's like going to the gym or yoga or anything else, once the wave has crashed.
Mm.
And then there's also this idea that it's, because it's been adopted in the business world, which is great, by the way, you know, it's fantastic that we've got, when I was sitting opposite a banker on a train the other day who was doing the Headspace Take 5, you know, Take 5, plugged in.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. But the danger there, again, is that it's seen as something... Are you familiar with this idea of... it's a phrase called cow psychology?
No.
You heard that?
Was it cow?
The happier a cow is,
the
more milk you'll get.
Okay.
So this idea that it's being adopted by business, if you're being really cynical, suggests that actually they're not doing it because they're worried about the well-being of their staff. They're doing it because happier employees make more money.
Yeah.
So we're in a, you know, we're in a quite critical period at the moment about what happens to mindfulness in terms of how it's seen by the world at large, where we are in 10, 20, 30 years' time in terms of what people feel about it. It could go seriously wrong if we promise, if we over-promise what it can do for us, whether it's education or business or health or any part of life.
That's, so, yeah, to back up your point, yeah, it's not the panacea for all problems. I mean, you know, good old-fashioned loads of maths homework and spending time doing revision is still important. You can't learn the maths without doing the practice. So you know, practicing the questions and so the, yeah, so there is the, yeah, you can't expect miracles here. That's, yeah. That's, you know, it's a tool, if you like, an additional tool, and that is
absolutely. And moving away from, there's this other lovely phrase called muck mindfulness, you know, the fact that it's been adopted by lots of large scale businesses as something that, you know, makes them really cool and hip and good employers. Just to be really careful with that stuff, I think.
So Fran, in terms of your the martial arts, I wanted to think about, discuss a bit more about, because I mentioned sports, and I know you did the Muay Thai
Muay Thai, did a bit of boxing as well. So it was obviously before you go into the ring, your mind starts going a bit crazy, thinking, oh man, I hope I've trained enough for this. I wonder if the other guy has done this or that. But yeah, I mean, literally, you just have to take a couple of moments just to breathe and just, as you say, it's a bit like the exams, really, isn't it? If you just let yourself worry about all these things, you're not going to put yourself in a good state, and that's not going to help. That's not going to be helpful to yourself. In that sort of situation, it might be better for your opponent, but otherwise, I really just found it useful just to, even just for reflecting, I guess. Sometimes, you know, as you said earlier, you know, you can't unlearn it once you've learnt it. So sometimes, even if you're being a bit slack one day, you're having a bad day, and maybe you take it out on someone that you just bump into, or, you know, then after you kind of take it back and think, actually, I should have handled it a bit better. So it kind of does make you, even if you do kind of slip sometimes, you know, it kind of does bring it back to you and say, all right, you know, next time you can handle that better, or that situation, or it just wakes you up for the next time, you know, saying, actually, I thought I was really mindful, but then today I got pissed off with someone for cutting in front of me on the line, you know, so... it's just one of those things. It's an ongoing practice, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. I think Paul Ekman, the psychologist, said it's not like riding, although you can't unlearn it, I suppose, what we said today, but it's not like riding a bike where you just do it once. So it's an ongoing practice.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started it, actually, I found it difficult to actually just do it on a daily basis. And so I said to Paul, his name was, who introduced me to the MBSR program, and we did an 8-week course. And I said, how do you do it? You know, so after the course was complete, I said, it's time, it's this, even though I believe in the whole concept and I was quite enthusiastic, it was just, didn't get around to doing it. You know, so I was making up, and he said, well, just find a set time. If you make it a routine, so a set time in the morning, you know, when you wake up, is a perfect time to keep up the practice. Sorry,
I think doing anything where you're using your, like, say for instance, like, maybe just yoga as well, martial arts, music, playing a musical instrument, singing sometimes to one of your favorite songs, you know, that's also a form of meditation as well. I mean, I think that's one of the things, if we're addressing our mind and body separately, whereas obviously when you do a sport and you're engaged in it and you have to be there fully, so your mind and body are connected, which is what gives you that almost a feeling of
a flow.
Yeah, a little bit of a flow, like I don't quite know how to put that, but
that flow idea is really critical, isn't it? It's not so much what you're doing, but the quality you bring to it.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. That's right.
Things we teach, we have a whole lesson on how mindfulness is not something you have to take time out to do. It's a quality of everyday activities, whether it's washing the dishes or playing an instrument or doing a sport.
That's right.
we use Johnny Wilkinson, you know, the ex England captain, rugby captain,
yeah.
But, so mindfulness practitioner, and he talks really beautifully about his experience at that moment where he's about to try and, you know, do a conversion and standing there in front of the ball, and his mind could be, you know, with the audience and what they might be thinking about him, or projecting the future about what might go wrong and potentially catastrophizing about what might happen as a result of that, or reflecting back on previous practices where it all went really badly wrong for him. And instead he actually just roots himself, and he focuses his attention on his feet and the connection with the floor, mm-hmm. and on his hands,
yeah.
and on the ball, and then he tries to kick, and that's why he said he had a 98% conversion rate.
Wow. Why not? He should give advice to the England penalty takers for yeah. World
Cup. Wouldn't that be great?
Mm.
He used hugely in sport and very effectively, whether it's in basketball, Phil Jackson coaching LA Lakers and people like that,
wow.
and the women's American ice hockey team. It's there's huge evidence there to show the benefits of mindfulness in sport, and actually in performing arts as well. There's, you know, music, in drama, in I teach a course at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and dealing with things like performance anxiety and trying to access this magical thing called flow, which everyone strives for in arts and sport and whatever, and actually without a very act of striving for it is what completely blows it out of the water for you, because you can't strive for perfection, you can't strive for flow. It's a really interesting area. It's something that I'm quite excited to kind of explore a bit more, I think, through the work we do with schools and postgraduate students.
And I think something like that is really highlighted when you see a sports personality that is at the top of their game. An incident happens. Let me give you, like, Tiger Woods, for example.
Yeah.
Golf is extremely mental. You know, it's, you know, one little millimeter change here, the trajectory of the ball goes massively off. But he had this amazing ability, you know, one of the youngest golfers ever, and, you know, winning tournament after tournament, has this big scandal and has come back into professional golf. And, you know, he's not the same guy. You just can only imagine every time he's about to take a shot, he literally must feel the world on his shoulders. And it's, how do you balance all your thoughts, and how do you just, right, let me just concentrate on what I'm doing, let me get to this flow. So that, I mean, when you see it, like, you know, someone like Torres going from Liverpool to Chelsea, and then just being this player that, you know, you can't even buy a goal nowadays, you know, and it's, yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, sports psychologists say all the time, you know, I don't know what the exact percentages are, but they say, you know, it's kind of something like 50%. Physical and 50% psychological. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's different, I can't remember. Right. But, you know, I think any sports person or any performer in any sense needs to be doing practice, mm-hmm. as in the physical practice, mm-hmm. and then practice in terms of the mental practice. And I think it's the mental practice that really shifts things for people, mm-hmm. really makes the difference between, you know, being physically gifted and an outstanding performer.
Mm-hmm. So Claire, one thing that I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned that after kind of finding mindfulness for yourself, you began then teaching your students that.
Mm.
Was that out of your own initiative, right? You felt that you.
No,
no.
By that stage, I'd learned about the mindfulness.
Sure. Course. Okay. But you mentioned that they would organize their own groups and do like mindfulness sessions themselves.
Yeah.
I found that really, really fascinating, you know, and that they're not only seeing it as a subject, but they, you know, to grasp it as a group of students and then do it in their own time. So how did that go about?
It's funny, is when we get to the end of courses with students and with staff actually, and they say, "What's next?"
Yeah.
How do I keep this going? This is lovely, but, you know, realistically, me sitting in the room on my own once a day is not going to. Do it for me. So what we try to do is encourage kind of people supporting each other. I don't know how you guys feel, but I've always found that practicing mindfulness is much more fulfilling and actually more accessible for me if I do it as part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever possible, so, you know, why don't you all get together at lunchtime, or why don't you get together at the beginning of the day and practice together. And in a funny sort of way, if your objective is to kind of embed mindfulness in the culture of school, it's got to be more than, you know, eight weeks of sessions. It's mm-hmm. got to be something else going on there. Whether it's certainly in terms of schools, what we talk about is the kind of golden triangle of students having done it, teachers having done it, and if possible, parents.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is the whole other ball game, and they're getting mm-hmm. parents involved. There's a real sense of interest there, not least because the kids who've done, you know, Dot B or whatever it's called, be our primary school curriculum, they go home and they have a language and they start talking about, you know, the difference between reacting and responding, and they talk about thought buses and thoughts not being facts, and they talk about, we kind of use catchy phrases and catchy descriptions for different practices, which are both familiar mindfulness practices, but you know, they, we have new words for them. So they talk about fofbok, feet on the floor, bum on chair. And they go home to their parents, they talk about fofbok, and the parents come back and go, can you just explain what a fofbok is? And why is my child doing it? And then you explain, and then show them, can we do it, please? And can you do a course for us? And so there is a real interest there. The overwhelming feeling from parents is not cynicism or any sense of concern about what's being done. When they hear what it's all about and why they're doing it, they go, why aren't we doing it? My God.
Absolutely. Yeah. You mentioned seeing the banker with the Headspace app I think that's a wonderful way to spread it. I was only aware of the Headspace app quite recently, actually, and I showed one of my students because she had some personal difficulties and mm-hmm. anxiety and a few things, and I said, well, why don't you try downloading this app?
Mm-hmm.
And came back to me and said, wow, you know, it's really helped me. So I think to make it more accessible, maybe to parents, is just, or having something like that.
Yeah.
But nowadays with social media and YouTube, it's a lot easier to spread information, isn't it?
Yeah.
And something so quick and easy for them, I think, is makes it so.
Yeah, as you said, that's the thing, though. There's so much information out there. It's like what Claire was saying earlier as well. It's along the lines of how do you get people to want to focus their attention onto that, because there's so many other things that people could be watching, MTV or movies, whatever.
Yeah. I don't know. Could you mind explaining very quickly the puppy analogy? and there was one thing that I really enjoyed was the little Kung Fu Panda story as well.
Ideas that we use in. Well, both the puppy idea and Kung Fu Panda are both in Dot B, which is the teen curriculum, which is kind of 11 to 18-year-olds. And we also talk about the puppy mind in our primary curriculum, which is called Pause Dot B, as in puppy pause, but also pause as in, you know, stop and breathe and be. And the puppy works really well because we talk about how the mind... Well, first of all, we make a distinction between the brain and the mind. And obviously, the brain is the physical organ in your head, which is kind of stuck there, and the mind is your attention. It's where you focus your where you concentrate, where your mind is at any given stage, and for all kinds of really important evolutionary reasons, our minds have evolved to be on the lookout all the time for things that are interesting or potentially threatening. So they wander. That's what they do. They will go wherever there's a really interesting thing, a bit like a puppy. They'll go to what's interesting. They'll wander off. They'll come back. They'll bring you stuff back, perhaps, that you don't want, whether it's a memory or an idea. But, you know, they don't sit and stay. So it's rather useful. When you're going through that initial experience of trying to train your attention through focusing on your breath, focusing on physical sensations in your body, understanding that it's a bit like a puppy means that you can, A, change your relationship with it, and rather than getting upset with it, just notice that's what it does. That's what puppies do. That's what our minds do. They wander. They don't sit still. They sniff around aimlessly. And just like training a puppy, you know, you don't beat the puppy up if it gets it wrong. If it wanders off, you just gently guide it back. And it means you can do it lots of times through patient repetition. You know, that's what mindfulness practice is all about. So it's a really useful analogy.
Nice.
And then Kung Fu Panda. And there's this wonderful scene in Kung Fu Panda where, do you guys know Kung Fu Panda?
Yeah.
Yep. So you've got Po, the panda, who's accidentally found himself in a situation where he's been hailed as the new Kung Fu warrior, the dragon master, I think they call him, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And he's we always say to kids, you know, he's in an educational institution, and he's feeling out of place, and he's feeling like he's failing, and he's not as good as everyone else. He's constantly comparing himself to everyone else, and not least this kind of magical five, this group of five Kung Fu masters who are training with him. And we find him in this particular clip very dejected because he's had a really tough day, and he's really felt he's failed, and he's comfort eating. He's comfort eating peaches. And along comes Master Oogway, who's the kind of wise old master tortoise, who asks him why he's so upset. And Kung Fu Panda is a wonderful, brilliant moment because he's both physically and verbally doing stuff that we can all identify with. He's denying that there's a problem. There's no problem, you know. I'm upset. Why would I be upset? And also he's kind of eventually gives in to the fact that he just feels he's failed. He catastrophizes. He says, you know, I'm never going to be good enough. This is never going to work. He goes over, plays over stuff that's happened. He ruminates. It's all that lovely MBCT mindfulness stuff going on there. And then eventually Master Oogway turns to him and says, you know, just focus on the present moment. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery, but today is a gift. Mm-hmm. That is why it is called the present. Mm-hmm. Which is actually Eleanor Roosevelt, I should point out.
Yeah.
She said that originally, but it's just a lovely illustration of A, someone in conflict with themselves,
mm-hmm.
feeling inadequate, feeling they're never going to be as good as anybody else. You know, things we can all identify with. And then just a really valuable reminder about, you know, don't project into the future, don't reflect on the past, mm-hmm. try and be in the present moment, because that's what really matters, that's what life is all about.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah, what a great way to end the podcast. have you
Panda,
right? Yeah. Have you met JKZ or Mr. Jon Kabat-Zinn?
Yeah, came to our conference last year.
Oh, wonderful!
Speakers at conference, amazing guy.
Yes.
Yeah, bit of a hero now. All right. So, how can people find out more? There's the mindfulnessinschools.org website.
Yeah.
There's also the bemindful.co.uk.
Yeah, that's where they can find out about general, that's run by the Mental Health Foundation, and that's, if they're interested in doing an initial 8-week introductory course to mindfulness, that's a really great place to start to find out about what's going on. You can locate courses in your area, which is really useful.
Is that, 8 weeks is a number that I hear quite a lot, and the Danny Penman's book that he wrote with Mark Williams was, you know, that 8 week, as well. Is that where it comes from, the 8 weeks?
It's 8 weeks because the research evidence shows that that's when you get significant shifts in structural and functional brain activity. You know, the work that JKZ did, the work that Mark Williams and Danny Penman have done, categorically, if you do the practice every day that you're set, whether it's through Mark Williams and Danny's Frantic World book or any other practice, after 8 weeks, that's when you see the shift. That's when the real changes take.
Okay. And are you on Twitter?
We are.
Yep.
At Mr. Tweets. I'm on Facebook, Mindfulness and Schools Projects. So find out more, get in touch, ask questions. Always happy to chat and discuss and talk through what's going on.
Lovely. Well, I'll put all these links on the websites with the podcast episodes, so everyone have one easy place to go grab it all. You know, I'll do a few bits of Ed Sinclair. I'll send you a copy, let you give the thumbs up first before we do anything with it, or send it out, and then I'll shoot it out.
Ooh, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been an absolute pleasure and an honour for us to have this conversation.
Thank you.
All right. I'll be in touch soon, Claire. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Some of the smartest dummies can't read the language of Egyptian mummies on a flag or a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youths, cause it's not like the future depends on it. We'll save the animals in the zoo, how the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep pants, and all of a sudden you are say a Indiana Jones. And I tip out the gold and tip out the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzis I've ever seen and I've ever known. Put the words on this place so the world can see, and that's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'd be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them are gonna flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them still can't defeat and them could have never clone. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord. Are we born knowing all? We growing wiser? Are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was flat, if you went too far you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again everybody would have started laugh. The average man can't prove up most of the things that he chooses to speak of, and still run research and find out the root of the truth that you seek of. Scholars teach in universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose start running. And the rich get stitched up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can you read signs? Can you read stars? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows even though you drive cars? Can you survive against all odds?
Who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve in candy. Microwave it, try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming. Eating, deleting, ruin. Trying to get paper. What? Gotta have land, gotta have acres. True. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsy seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw soul over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. A fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier since 7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Damn. Savali. Patience.